Point or Kachu will veer us off, letting any pursuers keep following the main party. Soon they were alone on the high step. Urantai trotted alongside, agile and contemptuous of the awkward humans, who winced, dragging their toes as they rode. In reaction, the men began taking turns sliding off their mounts to run at a steady lope for several arrow flights before swinging back aboard. This shut up the derisive Urs, and also seemed a good way to avoid saddle sores. Alas, Sarah knew she was in no physical condition to try it. "If I live through this, I'm definitely getting into shape," she thought. "Not for the first time." The man with slate eyes ran next to Sarah for a few duras, sparing her a wry, eloquent smile. He was so wiry and strong, it amazed Sarah that she recognized him. The last time she had seen Savant Dettinger, he was a pale intellectual with a middle-aged paunch, an expert on the most ancient scrolls, and author of a text Sarah carried in her own slim luggage. A man once honored with status and trust, till his orthodox fanaticism grew too extreme for even the broad-minded High Council. These days, the sages preached a complex faith of divided loyalty, split evenly between Jijo, on the one hand, and the ancestors' outlaw plan, on the other. It was a tense trade-off. Some solved it by choosing one allegiance over the other. Sarah's brother gave his full devotion to the planet. Lark saw wisdom and justice in the billion-year-old galactic ecological codes. To him, no fancied path of redemption could ever make up for flouting those rules. Dettinger took the opposite extreme. He cared little about ecology or species preservation, only the racial deliverance promised by the scrolls, seeking pure innocence as a way to better days. Perhaps he also saw in this crisis a way to regain lost honors. By moonlight, Sarah watched the banished sage move with wiry grace, alert, focused, powerful, living testimony for the simpler style that he preached. "Deceptively simple," she thought. "The world has countless ways for not being quite as it seems." The Urantai slowed after a while, then stopped to rest and eat. Those with pouched husbands, or larvae, needed warm Simla blood every midura or so, although the human raiders chafed and complained, preferring a steady pace over the Urish fashion of hurry and relax. Soon after the second of these breaks, Urkachu veered the party onto a stony ledge that extended roughly southeast, like the backbone of some fossilized behemoth. Rougher terrain slowed the pace, and Sarah took advantage to dismount, giving respite to the donkey and her own bottom. Exercise might also take some chill stiffness out of her joints. She kept her right arm on the saddle, though, in case some unseen stone made her stumble in the dark. The going went a little easier with second moonrise. Backlit by silvery torgon, the mountains seemed to loom larger than ever. Northside glaciers drank the satellite's angled light, giving back a peculiar blue luminance. The stranger sang for a while, a sweet, soft melody that made Sarah think of loneliness.
"I am a barren island, apart in the desalt sea, and the nearest skein of land is my stark thought o' thee. Oh, say I were a chondrite, tumbling soul and free, would you be my garner boat, and come to amass me?"
It was Anglic, though of a dialect Sarah had never heard, with many strange words. It was problematical how much the Starman still grasped. Still, the unrolling verses doubtless roused strong feelings in his mind.
Am I the ice that slakes your thirst, that twinkles your bright rings? You are the phantom angel kin, whose kiss gives planets wings.
The recital ended when Urkachu trotted back, nostril flaring, to complain about unbearable earthling caterwauling. A purely personal opinion, Sarah felt, since none of the other Urs seemed to mind. Music was on the short list of things the two races tended to agree about. Some Urs even said that for bringing the vilest to Jijo, they could almost overlook human stench. For an auntie, Urkachu seemed a particularly irritable sort. The man from space fell silent, and the group traveled in a moody hush, punctuated by the clip-clop of the animal's hooves on bare stone. The next blood stop took place on the wind-sheltered lee side of some towering slabs that might be natural rock forms, but in the dimness seemed like ruins of an ancient fortress toppled in a long-ago calamity. One of the weathered desert men gave Sarah a chunk of gritty bread, plus a slab of bush cow cheese that was stale, but tasty enough to one who found herself ravenously hungry. The water ration was disappointing, though. The Urs saw little point in carrying much. Around midnight, the party had to ford a wide, shallow stream that flowed through a desert wadi. Always prepared, Ulgor slipped on sealed booties, crossing with dry feet. The other Urish rebels slogged alongside the humans and animals, then dried each other's legs with rags. After that, the Uruntai seemed eager to run for a while, till the moisture wicked out of their fibrous ankle fur. When the pace slackened again, Sarah slid off her mount to walk. Soon a low voice spoke from her right.
"I meant to tell you, I've read your paper on linguistic devolution from Indo-European."
It was the scholar-turned-hunter, Dettinger, striding behind her donkey's other flank. She watched him for a long moment before answering.
"I'm surprised. At 50 pages, I could afford to get only 5 photocopies cranked, and I kept one."
Dettinger smiled.
"I still have friends in Byblos who send me engaging items now and then. As for your thesis, while I enjoyed your ideas about grammatical reinforcement in pre-literate trading clans, I'm afraid I can't bring myself to accept your general theory."
Sarah didn't find it surprising. Her conclusions ran counter to everything the man believed in.
"That's the way of science, a cycle of give and take, no dogmatic truth, no rigid received word."
"As opposed to my own slavish devotion to a few ancient scrolls that no human had a hand in writing?"
The flinty man laughed.
"I guess what it comes down to is which direction you think people are heading. Even among conservative galactics, science is about slowly improving your models of the world. It's future-oriented. Your children will know more than you do, so the truth you already have can never be called perfect."
"That's fine when your destiny lies upward, Sarah, but tradition and a firm creed are preferable if you're embarked on the narrow, sacred road downhill to salvation. In that case, argument and uncertainty will only confuse your flock."
"Your flock doesn't seem confused," she acknowledged.
He smiled.
"I've had some success winning these hard men over to true orthodoxy.
They dwell much of each year on the plain of sharp sand, trapping the wild spike sloths that lurk in caves under the dunes. Most don't read or write, and their few tools are handmade, so they were already far down the path. It may prove harder convincing some other groups.
Like the Explosers Guild?
The former scholar nodded.
An enigmatic clan. Their hesitation to do their duty during this crisis is disturbing.
Sarah raised her eyes toward Kurt and Joma. While the senior Exploser snored atop an ambling donkey, his nephew held another one-sided conversation with the stranger, who smiled and nodded as Joma chattered. The Starman made an ideal, uncritical audience for a shy boy, just beginning to express himself.
"Maybe they figure they can blow it all up just once," Sarah commented. "Then they'll have to scratch for a living like everyone else."
Dettinger grunted.
"If so, it's time someone reminded them, respectfully, of their obligations."
She recalled Jop's talk of taking Kurt somewhere to be persuaded. In more violent times, the expression carried chilling implications.
"We may be headed back to such times."
The flinty insurgent shook his head.
"But never mind all that. I really want to discuss your fascinating paper. Do you mind?"
When Sarah shrugged, Dettinger continued in an amiable tone, as if they sat in a Biblos faculty lounge.
"You admit that Proto-Indo-European and many other human mother tongues were more rigorous and rational than the dialects that evolved out of them. Right so far?"
"According to books carried here by the Tabernacle, all we have is inherited data."
"And yet you don't see this trend as an obvious sign of decay from perfection? From original grammars designed for our use by a patron race?"
She sighed. There might be weirder things in the universe than holding an abstract chat with her kidnapper under a desert sky, but none came to mind.
"The structure of those early tongues could have risen out of selective pressure, operating over generations. Primitive people need rigid grammars because they lack writing or other means to correct error and linguistic drift."
"Ah, yes. Your analogy to the game of telephone, in which the language with the highest level of shaman coding..."
"That's Shannon coding. Claude Shannon showed that any message can carry within itself the means to correct errors that creep in during transit. In a spoken language, this redundancy often comes embedded in grammatical rules, the cases, declensions, modifiers, and such. It's all quite basic information theory."
"Hmm. Maybe for you. I confess that I failed to follow your mathematics."
Dettinger chuckled dryly.
"But let's assume you're right about that. Does not such clever, self-correcting structure prove those early human languages were shrewdly designed?"
"Not at all. The same argument was raised against biological evolution, and later against the notion of self-bootstrapped intelligence. Some folks have a hard time accepting that complexity can emerge out of Darwinian selection.
But it does."
"So you believe
that the same thing happened to preliterate languages on Earth? Cultures with stronger grammars could hang together over greater distances and times. According to some of the old-timer linguists, Indo-European may have ranged all the way from Europe to Central Asia. Its rigid perfection maintained culture and trade links over distances far beyond what any person might traverse in a lifetime. News, gossip, or a good story could travel slowly by word of mouth all the way across a continent,
arriving centuries later, barely changed.
Like in the game of telephone.
That's the general idea.
Sarah found herself leaning on the donkey as fatigue prickled her calves and thighs. Still, it seemed a toss-up, aching muscles if she stayed afoot, versus shivering on a bruised coccyx if she remounted. For the little donkey's sake, she chose to keep walking.
Dettinger had his teeth in the argument. If all you say is true, how can you deny those early grammars were superior to the shabby, disorganized dialects that followed?
What do you mean, superior? Whether you're talking about Proto-Indo-European, Proto-Bantu, or Proto-Semitic, each language served the needs of a conservative, largely changeless culture of nomads and herders for hundreds or thousands of years. But those needs shifted when our ancestors acquired agriculture, metals, and writing. Progress changed the very notion of what language was for. An expression of earnest confusion briefly softened the man's etched features.
Pray, what could language be for if not to maintain a culture's cohesion and foster communication?
That was the question posed by members of Dettinger's former department, who spurned Sarah's theory at its first hearing, embarrassing her in front of sages Bonner, Taine, and Perofsky. Had not the majestic civilization of the five galaxies been refining its 20 or so standard codes since the days of the fabled progenitors, with a single goal? To promote clear exchange of meaning among myriad citizen races?
There is another desirable thing, Sarah replied. Another product of language, just as important in the long run as cohesion.
And that is?
Creativity. If I'm right, it calls for a different kind of grammar, a completely different way of looking at error.
One that welcomes error, embraces it.
Dettinger nodded.
This part of your paper I had trouble following. You say Anglic is better because it lacks redundancy coding, because errors and ambiguity creep into every phrase or paragraph. But how can chaos engender inventiveness?
By shattering preconceptions, by allowing illogical, preposterous, even obviously wrong statements to parse in reasonable-sounding expressions. Like the paradox, this sentence is a lie, which can't be spoken grammatically in any formal galactic tongue. By putting manifest contradictions on an equal footing with the most time-honored and widely held assumptions, we are tantalized, confused. Our thoughts stumble out of step.
This is good.
It's how creativity works, especially in humans. For every good idea, 10,000 idiotic ones must first be posed, sifted, tried out, and discarded. A mind that's afraid to toy with the ridiculous will never come up with the brilliantly original. Some absurd concept that future generations will assume to have been obvious all along. One result has been a profusion of new words, a vocabulary vastly greater than ancient languages, words for new things, new ideas, new ways of comparing and reasoning.
Dettinger muttered,
"And new disasters, new misunderstandings."
Sarah nodded, conceding the point.
It's a dangerous process. Earth's bloody past shows how imagination and belief turn into curses unless they're accompanied by critical judgment. Writing, logic, and experimentation help replace some of the error correction that used to come embedded in grammar. Above all, mature people must consider that most unpleasant of all possibilities— that their own favorite doctrines might prove wrong. she watched Dettinger. Would the man catch on that she had aimed that barb at him? The exiled pedagogue gave Sarah a wry smile.
"Has it occurred to you, Miss Sarah, that your last statement could apply to you and your own beloved hypothesis?"
Now it was Sarah's turn to wince, then laugh aloud.
"Human nature. Each of us thinks we know what we're talking about, and those disagreeing are fools. Creative people see Prometheus in a mirror, never Pandora."
Dettinger spoke with an ironic edge. "Sometimes the torch I carry scorches my fingers." Sarah could not tell how much he meant the remark in jest. Often she found it easier to read the feelings of a Hoon or Gekek than some members of her own enigmatic race. Still, she found herself enjoying the conversation, the first of its kind in quite some time.
"As for Transhiran Jijo, just look at the new rhythmic novels being published by some of the northern Urish tribes, or the recent burst of Hoonish romantic poetry, or the Galtu haiku imagery coming out of the Vale."
A sharp whistle cut her short, a guttural stop command piped by Urkachu's upstretched throat. The queue of tired animals jostled to a halt as the Urantai leader pointed north of a stone spire, decreeing that a camouflaged shelter be raised in its long tapered shadow.
In its shadow.
Blinking, Sarah looked around to see that the night was over. Dawn light filtered over the peaks, sifting through an early morning haze. They had climbed among the mountains, or at least the rocky foothills, leaving behind the parched Warrel Plain. Alas, they were by now far south of the well-worn trail leading to the Glade of Gathering. Dettinger's courtliness clashed with his rough appearance as he excused himself to organize his men.
"I've enjoyed matching wits," he told her with a bow. "Perhaps we can resume later?"
"Perhaps."
Although the discussion had been a pleasant diversion, she had no doubt the man would sacrifice her, along with all of her ideas, on the altar of his faith. Sarah vowed to be ready for any occasion to sneak her friends away from these fanatics.
"Right. An old man, a boy, a chimpanzee, a wounded alien, and an out-of-shape intellectual. Even if we got a huge head start, these Urs and desert men would catch us faster than you can transform a sine wave."
Still, she gazed north toward high peaks, where momentous events were taking place in hidden valleys, and thought,
"We'd better move fast, or else Ifni, God and the universe, will surely move on without us."
Asks. "Now comes our turn to threaten. Proctors fight to hold back a furious throng, hemming our erstwhile guests inside a circle of rage. The remaining alien lovers, mostly humans, form a protective ring around the star beings, while the twin robots swoop and dive, enforcing a buffer zone with bolts of stinging lightning. Lester Campbell steps forward, raising both hands for calm. The raucous noise ebbs as members of the mob ease their pressure on the harried proctors. Soon, silence reigns. No one wants to miss the next move in this game, wherein all of us on Jijo are tokens being gambled to be won or lost, counting on our skill and luck." Lester bows to the Rothan emissary. In one hand, he bears a stack of metal plates.
Now let's drop all pretense,
he tells the star god.
We know you for what you are, nor can you trick us into genocidal suicide doing your dirty work. Furthermore, should you try to do the job yourselves, annihilating all witnesses to your illegal visit, you will fail. All you'll accomplish is to increase your list of crimes. We recommend that you be satisfied. Take what you will from this world, and go.
The male star-human bursts forth, outraged.
How dare you speak so to a patron of your race?
Ron chastises, red-faced.
Apologize for your insolence.
But Lester ignores Ron, whose status has diminished in the eyes of the six. A toady servant does not dictate to a sage, no matter what godlike powers he wields. Instead, our human envoy offers one of the metal plates to Roken.
We are not proud of this art form. It uses materials that won't age or degrade back into Mother Gijo's soil. Rather, it is adamant, resistant to time. Properly stored, its images will last until this world again teems with legal, sapient life. Normally, we would send such dross to where Gijo can recycle it in fire. But in this case, we'll make an exception.
The Rothan emissary turns the plate in the morning light. Unlike a paper photograph, this kind of image is best viewed from certain angles. I know what it depicts, do we not, my rings? The plate shows Roken and his comrades just before that ill-starred pilgrimage, a journey whose horrors still drip vexingly down our waxy core. Bloor, the portraitist, developed the picture to serve as an instrument of blackmail.
Other images depict your party in various poses, performing surveys, testing candidate species, often with backgrounds that clearly portray this place, this world. The shape of glaciers and eroding cliffs will set the date within 100 years, perhaps less.
The rauk covering my torus of vision reveals ripples crisscrossing Roken's face. Again, a dissonance of clashing emotions. But which ones? Are we getting better at reading this alien life form? The second of our cognition rings seems deeply curious about the clashing colors. The Rothan holds out an elegant hand.
May I see the others?
Lester hands them over.
This is but a sampling, naturally a detailed record of our encounter with your ship and crew, has also been etched on durable metal to accompany these pictures into hiding.
Naturally,
Roken answers smoothly, perusing one plate after another, turning them in the sunshine.
You have retained unusual arts for self-accursed sooners. Indeed, I have never seen the like, even in civilized space.
This flattery draws some murmurs from the crowd. Roken is once more being charming. Lester continues,
Any acts of vengeance or genocide against the Six will also be chronicled this way. It is doubtful you can wipe us out before hidden scribes complete such a record.
Doubtful indeed.
Roken pauses, as if considering his options. Given his earlier arrogance, we had expected outrage over being blackmailed in this way, plus indignation over the implied disrespect. It would not surprise us to see open contempt for an effort by half-beasts to threaten a deity. Instead, do we now perceive something like cautious calculation cross his features? Does he realize we have him cornered? Roe Ken shrugs in a manner not unlike a human.
What shall be done, then? If we agree to your demands, how can we be certain these will not reappear anyway to plague our descendants some day? Will you sell these records to us now, in return for our promise to go in peace?
Now it is Lester who laughs. Turning half toward the crowd, he gestures with one hand.
Had you come after the commons experienced another century or two of peace, we might have trustingly accepted. But who among us has not heard stories told by old-timers who were there when Broken Tooth deceived Orjo Una near False Bridge at the end of the old wars? What human has not read moving accounts of some great-grandfather who escaped the slaughter at Truce Gorge during the Year of Lies?
He turned back to Roken.
Our knowledge of deceit comes self-taught. Peace was hard won, its lessons not forgotten. No, mighty Rothen, with apologies we decline, simply to take you at your word.
This time, a mere flick of one slender hand holds back the outraged Ron, checking another outburst. Roe Ken himself seems amused, although the strange dissonance once more cuts his visage.
Then what guarantee have we that you will destroy these items and not leave them in a place where they may be found by future tenants of this world, or worse, by galactic institutes, as little as 1,000 years from now?
Lester is prepared with an answer.
There is irony here, O mighty Rothen. If we as a people remember you, then we are still witnesses who can testify against your crime. Thus, if we retain memory, you have reason to act against us. If, on the other hand, we successfully follow the path of redemption and forgetfulness, in 1,000 years we may already be like laborers, innocuous to you, no longer credible to testify. If so, you will have no cause to harm us. To do so would be senseless, even risky.
True, but if you have by that time forgotten our visit, would you not also forget the hiding places where you cached these images?
Roe Ken holds up a plate.
They will lie in ambush, like lurker missiles, patiently awaiting some future time to home in on our race.
Lester nodded.
That is the irony. Perhaps it can be solved by making a vow of our own, to teach our descendants a song, a riddle, as it were, something simple that will resonate even when our descendants have much simpler minds. And what function will this puzzle serve?
We will tell our children that if ever beings come from the sky who know the riddle's answer, they must retrieve these items from sacred sites, handing them over to the Star Lords, your own successors, O mighty Rothen. Naturally, if we six retain detailed memory of your crime, we sages will prevent the handover, for it will be too soon. But that memory will not be taught to children, nor passed on with the same care as we teach the riddle. For to remember your crime is to hold on to a poison, one that can kill. We would rather forget how and why you ever came. Only then will we be safe from your wrath.
It is an ornately elaborate bargain that Lester offers. In council, he had been forced to explain its logic 3 times. Now the crowd mutters, parsing the idea element by element, sharing bits of understanding, until a murmur of admiration flows like molten clarity around the circle of close-pressed beings. Indeed, the bargain contains inherent elegance.
How shall we know that all the items will be accounted for in this way?
Ro Ken asks.
To some extent, you must trust to luck. You were gamblers coming on this mission in the first place, were you not, mighty Rothan? I can tell you this, we have no grand desire to have these images arrive across the ages for Institute lawyers to pore over, looking for reasons to punish our own species cousins still roaming the stars. In their hardness and durability, these plates are an insult to our own goal on this world, to be shriven down to innocence, to earn a second chance.
Ro Ken ponders this.
It seems we may have come to Jijo a few thousand years too soon. If you succeed in following your path, this world will be a treasure trove.
His meaning is not clear at first. Then a mutter passes through the crowd, from Urish snorts to Kerwinish hisses, and finally booming Hoonish laughter. Some are impressed by Ro Ken's wit, others by the implied compliment that the Rothan would wish to adopt any pre-sentient races that we 6 might become. But that reaction is not universal. Some of those assembled seethe angrily, rejecting any notion of adoption by Ro Ken's folk. Do we, I, find this anger silly, my rings? Have client races any control over who becomes their patron? Not according to lore we've read. But those books will be dust long before any of this comes to pass.
Shall we swear oaths?
Ro Ken asks.
This time, based on the most pragmatic assurance of all, mutual deterrence. By this new arrangement, we shall depart in our ship, waiting only till our scout craft returns from its final mission, choking back whatever bitterness we feel over the foul murder of our comrades. In return, you all vow to forget our intrusion and our foolish effort to speak through the voice of your holy egg.
It is agreed, replies knife-bright Insight, clicking 2 claws. Tonight we'll confer and choose a riddle whose secret key will be told to you. When next your kind comes to Jijo, may it be to find a world of innocence. That key will guide you to the hiding place. You may then remove the dross images. Our deal will be done.
Hope washes over the crowd, striking our rauk as a wave of soft green tremors. Can we credit the possibility, my rings, that the 6 might live to see a happy ending? To the zealots, this seems all that they desired. Their young leader dances jubilation. Now there will be no punishment for their violent acts. Rather, they will be known as heroes of the commons.
What do you say? My ring? Our second cognition torus reminds us that some heretics might prefer that angry fire and plagues rid Gijo of this infestation called the Six. And yes, there is yet another, even smaller heretical fringe, eccentrics who foresee our destiny lying in a different direction, scarcely hinted by sacred scrolls. Why do you bring this up, my ring? What possible relevance can such nonsense have at this time and place? Scribes write down details of the pact. Soon high sages will be called to witness and assent. Prepare, my lower rings. Meanwhile, we ponder again the anomaly brought to our waxy notice by the rauk, which still conveys vexing colors from Roken. Could they be shades of deceit? Deceit and amusement? Eager gladness to accept our offer, but only in appearance, buying time until... Stop it! We command our second ring, which gets carried away all too easily. It has read too many novels. We do not know the Rothen well enough to read subtle, complex meanings in his alien visage. Besides, don't we have Roken trapped? Has he not reason to fear the images on those plates of hard metal? Logically, he dare not risk them being passed on to incriminate his race, his line. Or does he know something we do not? Ah, what a silly question to ask when pondering a star god. While hope courses the crowd, we grow more nervous by the dura. What if they care nothing about the photographs? Then Roken might agree to anything, for it would not matter what vows were signed once his almighty ship arrives. From that point on, with his personal safety assured, we never get a chance to complete that dripping contemplation, for suddenly something new happens. Far too quickly for wax to ooze. It begins with a shrill human cry. One of the sycophants, a devoted Rothen follower, points behind the star beings toward the raised bier where their two dead comrades lie. Silky cloths had been draped across the two who were slain in the explosion, but now we see those coverings are pulled back, exposing the late Rothen and the late Sky Human. Do we now perceive Bloor the portraitist, poised with his recording device, attempting to photograph the faces of the dead? Bloor ignores growls of anger rising from those who follow the Rothen as patrons. Calmly, he slides out one exposed plate and inserts another. He appears entranced, focused on his art, even as attention turns his way from Ron. Then an outraged Roken, who screams in terse Galactic Six. Bloor glimpses the swooping robot and has time to perform one last act of professionalism. With his fragile body, the portraitist shields his precious camera and dies. Have patience, you lesser rings that lie farthest from the senses. You must wait to caress these memories with our inner breath. For those who squat higher up in our tapered cone, events come as a flurry of muddled images. Behold, the livid anger of the star gods, apoplectic with affronted rage. Observe the futile cries of Lester, Vubbin, and Fuhundau, beseeching restraint. Witness Bloor's crumpled ruin, a smoldering heap. Note how the crowd backs away from the violence, even as other dark-clad figures rush inward from the forest rim. Quail from the roaring robots charging up to strike, ready to slay at command. Above all, stare at the scene right before us, the one Bloor was photographing when he died. An image to preserve as long as this tower of rings stands. Two beings lie side by side. One, a human female, seems composed in death, her newly washed face serene, apparently at peace. The other figure had seemed equally tranquil when we saw it last before dawn. Ropol's visage was like an idealized human, impressive in height and breadth of brow, in strong cheekbones and the set of her woman-like chin, which in life had sustained a winning smile. That is not what we see now. Rather, a quivering thing, suffering its own death tremors, creeps off of Ropol's face, taking much of that face with it. The very same brow and cheek and chin we had been pondering, these make up the body of the creature which must have ridden the Rothen as a rauk rides one of the six, nestled so smoothly in place that no join or seam was visible before. Does this explain the dissonance, the clashing colors conveyed by our veteran Rauk? When some parts of Ro Ken's face relayed tart emotions, others always seemed cool, unperturbed, and friendly. It crawls aside, and onlookers gasp at what remains. A sharply narrower face, chinless and spiny, with cranial edges totally unlike a human being's. Gone is the mirage of heavenly comeliness in earthling terms. Oh, the basic shape remains humanoid, but in a tapered, predatory caricature of our youngest sept.
Haroon, I have seen this face before,
croons Fuhundau, stroking his white beard.
In my readings at Byblos, an obscure race with a reputation for...
Ron whips the covering back over the corpses, while Ro Ken shrilly interrupts.
This is the final outrage.
Our Rauk now clearly show Ro Ken as two beings, one a living mask. Gone is the patient amusement, the pretense at giving in to blackmail. Until now, we had nothing to blackmail with. Until now. The Rothen points to Ron, commanding,
Break radio silence and recall Kun now.
The prey will be warned, Ron objects, clearly shaken.
And the hunters, dare we risk?
We'll take that chance. Obey now. Recall Kun, then clear all of these away.
Roken motions at the crowd, the sycophants, and all six sages.
No one leaves to speak of this.
The robots start to rise, crackling with dire strength. A moan of dread escapes the crowd. Then, as is sometimes said in Earthling tales, all hell breaks loose.
The Stranger. He strums the dulcimer slowly, plucking one low note at a time, feeling nervous over what he plans to attempt, yet also pleased by how much he is remembering. About Urs, for instance. Ever since first regaining consciousness aboard the little river boat, he had tried to pin down why he felt so friendly toward the four-footed beings, despite their prickly, short-tempered natures. Back at the desert oasis, before the bloody ambush, he had listened to the ballad recited by the traitor Ulgor, without understanding more than a few click phrases here and there. Yet the rhythmic chant had seemed strangely familiar, tugging at associations within his battered brain. Then all at once, he recalled where he heard the tale before, in a bar, on far away. Names are still hard to come by, but now, at least, he has an image rescued from imprisoned memory. A scene in a tavern catering to low-class sapient races like his own, frequented by star travelers sharing certain tastes in food, music, and entertainment. Often, songs were accepted as currency in such places. You could buy rounds of drinks with a good one, and he seldom had to pay cash, so desired were the tunes warbled by his talented crewmates. Crewmates. Now he confronts another barrier, the tallest, harshest wall across his mind. He tries once more, but fails to come up with a melody to break it down. Back to the bar, then. With that recollection had come things he once knew about Urs, especially a trick he used to pull on Urish companions when they dozed off after a hard evening's revelry. Sometimes he would take a peanut, aim carefully, and... The stranger's train of thought breaks as he realizes he is being watched. Urkachu glares at him, clearly irritated by the increasing loudness of the thrumming dulcimer. He quickly mollifies the leader of the Urish ambushers by plucking at the string more softly. Still, he does not quite stop. At a lower, quieter level, the rhythm is mildly hypnotic, just as he intended it to be. The other raiders, both Urs and men, lie down or snooze through the broiling middle of the day. So does Sarah, along with Pretty and the other captives. The stranger knows he should rest, too, but he feels too keyed up. He misses Pizora, though it does seem strange to long for the healing touch of a Jofer. No, that is the wrong word. Pizora is not one of those fearsome, cruel beings, but a Treyiki, something quite different. As he grows a little better at names, he is going to have to remember that. Anyway, he has work to do. In the time remaining, he must learn to use the rauk that Sarah bought for him, a strange creature whose filmy body covers his eyes, causing soft colors to waft around every Urs and human, turning the shabby tent into a pavilion of revealing hues. He finds unnerving the way the rauk quivers over his flesh, using a sucker to feed from veins near the gaping wound in his head. Yet he cannot turn down a chance to explore yet another kind of communication. Sometimes the confusing colors coalesce to remind him of the last time he communed with Pizora,
back at the oasis. There had been a moment of strange clarity when their co-joined Rauks seemed to help convey exactly what he wanted. Pizora's answering gift lies inside the hole in his head, the one place the raiders would never think to search. He resists an urge to slip his hand inside to check if it's still there. All in good time. While he sits and strums, the oppressive heat slowly mounts. Urish and human heads sink lower to the ground, where night's lingering coolness can still be dimly felt. He waits and tries to remember a little more. His biggest blank zone, other than the loss of language, covers the recent past. If 10 fingers represent the span of his life up to now, most of the final 2 digits are missing. All he has are the shreds that cling whenever he wakes from a dream. Enough to know he once roamed the linked galaxies and witnessed things none of his kind ever saw before. The seals holding back those memories have resisted everything he's tried so far, drawing sketches, playing math games with Pretty, wallowing in Pizora's library of smells. He remains fairly certain the key will be found in music. But what music? Sarah snores softly nearby, and he feels a swelling of grateful fondness in his heart, combined with a nagging sense that there is someone else he should be thinking about. Another who had his devotion before searing fate swatted him out of the sky. A woman's face flickers at a sharp angle to his thoughts, passing too swiftly to recognize, except for the wave of strong feelings it evokes. He misses her, though he can't imagine that she feels the same wherever she may be, whoever she may be. More than anything else, he wishes he could put his feelings into words, as he never did during all the dangerous times they spent together. Times when she was pining for another, for a better man than he. This thought thread is leading somewhere, he realizes, feeling some excitement. Avidly, he follows it. The woman in his dreams, she longs for a man, a hero who was lost long ago, a year or two ago, lost with crewmates, and also along with the captain. Yes, of course, the commander they all missed so terribly, gone ever since a daring escape from that wretched water world. A world of disaster and triumph. He tries conjuring an image of the captain. A face? But all that comes to mind is a gray flash, a whirl of bubbles, and finally a glint of white, needle-like teeth. A smile unlike any other, wise and serene. Not human. And then, out of nowhere, a soft warbling emerges, a sound never before heard on the slope. My good silent friend, lost in winter's dread storm cloud, lonely, just like me. The whistles, creaks, and pops roll out of his mouth before he even knows he's speaking them. His head rocks back as a dam seems to shatter in his mind, releasing a flood of memories. The music he'd been looking for was of no human making, but the modern tongue of Earth's 3rd sapient race, a language painfully hard for humans to learn, but that rewarded those who tried. Trinary was nothing like Galactic 2 or any other speech, except perhaps the groaning ballad sung by great whales who still plumb the home world's timeless depths. Trinary. He blinks in surprise and even loses his rhythm on the plucked dulcimer. A few Urs lift their heads, staring at him blankly, till he resumes the steady cadence, continuing reflexively, while he ponders his amazing rediscovery. The familiar, uncanny fact that had eluded him till now. His crewmates. Perhaps they still await him in that dark, dreary place where he left them. His crewmates were dolphins.
Part 25. The Book of the Sea. Beware, ye damned who seek redemption. Time is your friend, but also your great foe. Like the fires of Ismanuti, it can fade before you are ready, letting in, once more, the things from which you fled. The Scroll of Danger. Alvin's Tale.
I tried reading Finnegan's Wake once upon a time. Last year. A lifetime ago. It's said that no non-Earthling has ever grokked that book. In fact, the few humans who managed the feat spent whole chunks of their lifespans going over Joyce's masterpiece, word by obscure word, with help from texts written by other obsessed scholars. Mr. Hines says no one on the slope has any hope at all of fathoming it. Naturally, I took that as a challenge, and so the next time our schoolteacher headed off to gathering, I nagged him to bring a copy back with him. No, I'm not about to say I succeeded. Just one page into it, I knew this was a whole different venture from Ulysses. Though it looks like it's written in pre-space English, The Wake uses Joyce's own language, created for a single work of art. Hoonish patience would not solve this. To even begin to understand, you have to share much of the author's context. What hope had I? Not a native speaker of Irish English, not a citizen of early 20th century Dublin, not human. I've never been inside a pub or seen a quark close up, so I can only guess what goes on in each. I recall thinking, maybe a little arrogantly, if I can't read this thing, I doubt anyone else on Jijo ever will. The crisp volume didn't look as if anyone had tried since the great printing. So why did the human founders waste space in Byblos with this bizarre intellectual experiment from a bygone age? That was when I felt I had a clue to the Tabernacle crew's purpose in coming to this world. It couldn't be for the reasons we're told on holy days when sages and priests read from the sacred scrolls. Not to find a dark corner of the universe to engage in criminally selfish breeding, or to resign from the cosmos seeking the roads of innocence. In either of those cases, I could see printing how-to manuals or simple tales to help light the way. In time, the books would turn brittle and go to dust when humans and the rest of us are ready to give them up, kind of like the Eloi folk in H.G. Wells's The Time Machine. In neither case did it make any sense to print copies of Finnegan's Wake. Realizing this, I picked up the book once more, and while I did not understand the story or allusions any better than before, I was able to enjoy the flow of words, their rhythms and sounds, for their own extravagant sake. It wasn't important anymore that I be the only person to grok it. In fact, there came a warm feeling as I turned the pages and thought, someday someone else is going to get more out of this than I did. On Jijo, things get stored away that seem dead, but that only sleep. I've been pondering that very thought while lying here in constant pain, trying to bear it stoically whenever strange silent beings barge into my cell to poke me with heat, cold, and prickly sharpness. I mean, should I feel hope as metal fingers probe my wounds? Or sour gloom that my blank face tenders refuse to answer any questions or even to speak? Shall I dwell on my awful homesickness, or on the contrary, thrill over having discovered something wonderfully strange that no one on the slope ever suspected, not since the Gekeks first sent their sneak ship tumbling into the deep? Above all, I wondered, am I prisoner, patient, or specimen? Finally, I realized, I just don't have any framework to decide. Like the phrases in Joyce's book, these beings seem at once both strangely familiar and completely unfathomable. Are they machines? Are they denizens of some ancient submarine civilization? Are they invaders? Do they see us as invaders? Are they Buir? I've been avoiding thinking about what's really eating away at me inside. Come on, Alvin, face up to it. I recall those final Duras when our beautiful Wufan's dream shattered to bits, when her hull slammed against my spine, when my friend spilled into the metal monster's mouth, immersed in cold, 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 cruel water. They were alive then, injured, dazed, but alive. Still alive when a hurricane of air forced out the horrid dark sea, leaving us to flop, wounded and half-dead, down to a hard deck. And when sun-bright lights half-blinded us and creepy spider things stepped into the chamber to look over their catch. But memory blurs at that point, fading into a hazy muddle of images, until I awoke here, alone. Alone. And worried about my friends.
Part 26. The Book of the Slope. Legends. We know that in the five galaxies, every star-faring race got its start through the process of uplift, receiving a boost to sapience from the patrons that adopted them. And those patrons were bestowed the same boon by earlier patrons, and so on, a chain of beneficence stretching all the way back to misty times when there were more than five linked galaxies, back to the fabled progenitors, who began the chain so very long ago. Where did the progenitors themselves come from? To some of the religious alliances that wrangle testily across the space lanes, that very question is anathema, or even likely to provoke a fight. Others deal with the issue by claiming that the ancient ones must have come from somewhere else, or that the progenitors were transcendent beings who descended graciously from a higher plane in order to help sapient life get its start. Of course, one might suggest that such facile answers simply beg the question, but it's unwise to suggest it too loudly. Some august galactics do not take it kindly when you point out their inconsistencies. Finally, there is one cult, the Affirmers, who hold the view that the progenitors must have self-evolved on some planet, bootstrapping to full sapiency all by themselves, a prodigious, nigh impossible feat. One might imagine that the Affirmers would be more friendly to Earthlings than most of the more fanatical alliances. After all, many Terrans still believe our race did the very same thing, uplifting ourselves in isolation, without help from anyone. Alas, don't expect much sympathy from the affirmers who see it as arrogant hubris for mere wolflings to make such a claim. Self-uplift, they maintain, is a phenomenon of the highest and most sacred order, not for the likes of creatures like us.
A Pragmatist's Introduction to Galactology by Jacob Demwa, reprinted from the original by Tarek Printers, Guild, Year of Exile, 1892. Dwer. It did no good to shout or throw stones at the Glaivers. The pair just retreated to watch from a